Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. I'm coming to you live from Madison in Wisconsin, all the way in the US, and I've got a very special guest today. I know we say this all the time about our guests, but that's because our guests are always great. And I have somebody who is quite esteemed and is quite respected, and it's quite an honor to have her all the way from Madison on our podcast today. I want to welcome Dr. Ainihi Edoard-Lines on our podcast. Say hi.
Hello, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, I don't even know where to begin. All I know is black girls are slaying. It's pretty, pretty cool. It's quite great to know that we've got so many amazing black women that are really doing the work of representation in literature. So, speaking of which, I was going to actually read out Annie's bio, but wow, I just felt like I wouldn't have even been able to do you justice. So what we're going to do is we're going to have you just introduce yourself a little bit. This might feel like one of those weird questions, those interview questions. Tell us about yourself. But just to give our readers a sense of who you are, what do you do, and why this work is so important.
Thank you very much, Alma, for having me. I am a fan of Cheeky Natives, and it's an honor to be here. I am an assistant professor of English.
Yes.
At University of Wisconsin-Madison in the English department. And I teach and research on African literature, writing on social media, and political theory. I run a literary news site called Brittle Paper. I think of it kind of as Africa's go-to site for news updates on literature and African literary culture. That's pretty much it.
All right, so you've said a little bit about Brittle Paper, but tell us where the name comes from, why you decided to start the Brittle Paper. There's quite an interesting story as to what was happening around the time that you started Brittle Paper. So I think just for our listeners, we're quite curious to know why it's called Brittle Paper and why you started it. And also just what is really the focus, the main focus of Brittle Paper?
Brittle Paper started in 2010. It was the end of my first year in graduate school at Duke University. I was doing my PhD there. And I had a really difficult year. Exciting, but very difficult, overwhelming. I did a lot of reading. I just thought that there was so much information, you know, to process as a graduate student. And I wanted to start this blog as a way to process what I was working through in my classes. And so the site started out as a literary and philosophy blog, mainly general interest stuff. Mm-hmm. I would write poetry, I would write essays, but everything was inspired by courses I was taking. So when I was taking a class on existentialism, you would see stuff like that there. When I was taking a class on Nietzsche and Wagner, you would see stuff like that there. And I kind of did that until 2012, when I decided to rebrand the site and make it into an African literature-centered site. And the reason I made that change was in part because I felt that there was a need for a discursive space for African literature. So, you know, you had the New York Times of the world, you had lots of just rich literary spaces where people could talk about things that mattered in relation to literature. You know, The Guardian, you know, Slate.com, Salon. Mm. There were so many places. But it felt like that with African literature, we were kind of missing that type of space. So that was one thing. But then secondly, I wasn't interested in simply reproducing existing models. Mm. I felt like we needed a space where we could, on a very basic level, have fun with African literature. Because mm-hmm. one thing I found tiring was the way in which African literature was kind of circulated within a discourse of erudition, right? Mm. So you think of African literature as something that, you know, you study in the classroom, something that talks about very serious, sad issues, you know, things that scholars cared about or that teachers cared about, you know. But if you wanted to have fun, you can read your J.K. Rowling's and you can read, you know, your fun Western fiction. But then when you wanted to learn serious things about the world, you read African literature. So I wanted to kind of break away from that discourse and created this space where people could actually just enjoy and have fun and be silly with African fiction. And Brittle Paper is kind of that cross between, you know, substantive literary discourse and a kind of culture of delight and fun. Mm.
So you've spoken about changing the way that we were consuming African literature. But you've also quite often spoken about the ways in which you feel like that translates into the marketing and the way people write about African literature, and use the example of two blurbs. One is an African writer and one is not, and the vast difference in that. Can you just tell us a little bit more about, can we expand a little bit more about the idea of changing the way that people write and the way that people consume African literature?
Right. The work of a critic, I think, is not simply to evaluate a book and tell us whether it's good or it's not good. The work of a critic many times is to kind of give us a point of entry into a text. So it's very important that critics are careful about the terms on which they are inviting readers to encounter a particular book. So if I'm talking about a book like Lolash Shonaim's The Secret Lives of Baba Segi's Wife, right? And I say that this is a book that gives us a searing look at polygamy, right? It's completely different from which is, yes, polygamy is the context of the novel, but it's actually a hilarious, funny novel.
Yes.
About a girl, a woman who is memorable as a character, yes, because there's so much about her that you connect with, right? But so, as opposed to say you describe the book as this kind of, you know, funny exploration of, you know, modern Nigerian relationships, something like that, right? So where the ways that we talk about African novels is very theme message driven, yes, right? It's about, yes, how does this text represent racism? How does it explore corruption?
Yes.
How does it highlight the child soldier syndrome? As opposed to what does the text do for the reader, in a sense of how can a reader encounter this text from a place of intimacy and delight, you know? And I think that the fault is not partly with critics, is also partly with the publishing industry, is also partly with the writers themselves, and it's also partly tied to a long tradition of African novels being able to command attention in a global literary market unless it presents itself as being some kind of native informant telling you something grand about the African world.
Speaking about this long history of the African novel having been, or the African writer having been treated and treating themselves in a certain way, you wrote, I don't think that controversial is quite the right word, but it's been a long day and my English is sort of running out, but there's an essay that you wrote and in which you, for example, were speaking about people referred to as the gods of African literature. And basically, there will be no holy cows. But one of the propositions that you really question in that essay is Achebe's proposition of education as a teacher, right? Mm-hmm. This representation of this novelist as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And you then expand on why you find this so problematic. I'm curious to just pick your mind about why that particularly stood out for you, why you felt that it was so important to comment on this notion of teacher as of writers, teacher, and of students being the reader.
I mean, it is absurd in some sense to me, right? That a fictional work recommends itself primarily on the basis of its capacity to teach you something. I mean, I think storytelling is something that you cannot reduce in that way.
Mm.
And Achebe, he loves to cite African folk tales as justification.
Mm.
Because, you know, African folk tales always end with some kind of didactic ending.
Mm.
But I mean, I have to say that that's not entirely an accurate picture.
Mm.
Because African folk tales also happen to be absolutely exciting.
Mm.
And some of them are deliciously ridiculous and fun. And then you can tell that the creators of this form, the most important goal is to delight the reader.
Yes.
Teaching is some kind of byproduct. If it happens, fine. If it doesn't happen, fine. So this idea that, you know, the African writer modeling the African folk tale teller positions him or herself as a kind of didactic, pedagogical figure, to me, is very odd.
Mm.
And I mean, and just the condescension of thinking of the reader as a student,
mm.
thinking of the reader as somebody who is never enough in themselves. You know, I mean, in a certain kind of old African literary discourse, you always encounter the broken reader, the derailed reader, the mad reader, the sad reader, who these writers have positioned themselves as wanting to save, wanting to correct. And like this, there's something disturbing about the incapacity to see the reader as somebody who, you know, is enough in themselves. And I also find it a little disingenuous that you have a literary discourse that justifies its existence on the basis of a broken reader. So what happens to African literature when we don't have any broken readers to repair anymore? Can we imagine an African literary discourse that is kind of like post-suffering, joy-centered African literature?
So you've spoken about this idea of what happens when readers themselves want to start thinking about a utopia outside of this concept of an Africa that is riddled with all of the struggles, or an Africa that is constantly having to teach you about polygamy or difficult relationships or difficult marriages. And it makes me think of Kolega Phuthuma, because it also makes me think of the ways in which people sort of take in our art. And it's something we'll expand on. But she says, how come when you ask Black people about their childhoods, you never want to know about the joy, the happiness, the playing? You know, the times in which my cousins and I would huddle together and we'd have... And I think some of that is also our own reproduction. Mm-hmm. Some of that is just us reproducing the ways in which the African novel must look like, you know? And so there's also a problem with the ways in which people talk about Africa and talk about African literature, right? And almost treat it as this anthropological study and not really as an art form that's quite rigorous, that's quite interesting, you know? And how do you think that we need to engage differently with African literature? Does it come into the books that we're writing? Is it the way that the books are published? Is it the people who get an audience? How can we engage with African literature in ways that are delightful or joyful?
I think it is being open to the idea that any kind of literary discourse is as great as it is rich and heterogeneous.
Yes.
Right. But so it's all well and good, you know, for people to write, to engage social issues, right? There's nothing wrong with that, right? But it's also good for us to make sure that we create these spaces where people who want to do something different can do it and have their books circulate in ways that they need to, right? And, I mean, I've seen this in Brittle Paper where we've shadowed kind of mentored writers from when they started out as unknown writers to when, you know, they become big time.
Mm.
There is a a dramatic shift from the way they write when they started out with us. You know, they would explore, they experimental, and in the moment they get that big publishing deal, what comes out is just this strangely, like, just cookie cutter novel that you've read a million times before. So there is this fear that if I don't write a novel that is recognizably African, based on the parameters that global publishing has defined as what African is, then my work is literally not going to be able to circulate. So how can we create a situation where people who choose to write all kinds of different things will be able to have their work circulate? And to me, a big part of that is kind of making sure that we invest in the infrastructure of publishing, right? So that different kinds of voices can be given a space to thrive. And also, I think it's also a thing with changing the taste of readers. Oh, actually, I take that back. It's kind of imagining a literary discourse that is not intimidated by being driven by the reader's taste, right? In the sense that African writers have a very eclectic taste. And it's actually unique, right? Because in Western publishing scene, there's a way that readers tend to read what they like, right? They exist in these generic silos, right? But I don't know if it's something to do with the way that we come to reading. Our tastes can be so diverse, in the sense that, you know, you're consuming highbrow literary fiction, but you're also reading your James Hadley Chase, right? And that, so there's a way that the African reader is actually a pretty exciting reader, right? And that, so I would imagine a literary discourse where we let this reader's taste and desires kind of fuel the ways that we organize books and talk about them. You know, because many times, you know, when people want to, you know, put their head down and read a fun book, they go to the West. Right, they go to the Western archive, right? And then when they want to read something, you know, hard, and they come to African literature. In fact, they call it African literature. You know, I have kids that they will tell you that, oh, yeah. You know, Things Fall Apart, you know, now is African literature. I think when they say it, it's as if, yes, it's for the hallowed gods. But, you know, when I want to have fun, I go and read my Harry Potter, and I go and read my Hunger Games, you know.
You've spoken about an investment in the infrastructure of publishing, but I think we've also seen with mediums like printed paper, for example, or the number of self-published authors that we've seen who've gone on to do really well, that there is a shift and that there is a need to change the way that we publish books and the way that we market books published by African authors. So for you, what would that investment look like in sort of rethinking the way that we publish books? Because the current model is just not working.
I mean, I think, you know, print culture is suffering everywhere, in some areas than others. On the continent specifically, print culture is in a very bad place, really bad place. So I would say that I see kind of the digital context as holding very interesting possibilities for publishing, in the sense that it's relatively cheaper to assemble kind of the whole gamut of publishing, of the publishing process, from editors to critics, and also to means of circulation. So I would say that since our print publishing is already kind of in a dismal position, and this is, I'm talking across the continent, because even South Africa, where it looks like, you know, a lot of publishing is happening, 99% of the publishing is not literary, and even an infinitesimal part of that literary publishing is being done by Black writers. So South Africa might seem to have a thriving print publishing industry, but it actually isn't. So I would say I see the future as kind of an investment in digital publishing, and also just in creating a wide-ranging avenues,
yes,
of literary discourse. So it's not just publishing, right? But it's things like prizes with actual real,
yes,
material consequences. So it's not like the Nigerian Literary Prize where you win $100,000 and it's just a check. It means nothing.
What?
Why do you have the shock on your face?
This is why there was an essay floating around recently. Mm-hmm. I hadn't had a chance to read it, where somebody who's a writer was really criticizing these literary awards, you know, because what do they bring? Like material, yeah, things, what do they bring?
They're literally just a check. Somebody, and Nigerian Literary Prize is the most absurd because it's Africa's richest prize. It's $100,000.
That you don't get.
That you get.
Okay.
Yeah, so they write you a check, that's it.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean all the people who have won that prize,
mm-hmm,
nobody hears about them.
Mm.
It doesn't translate into industry, yes, clout.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
If you win the Booker, it changes everything. You begin to circulate in the world in a completely different way.
Yeah.
We don't have prizes, mm, that can do that. That they actually industry engines, like,
yes,
that can have real material effects in the way that books are circulating and the way that books are accruing cultural, mm, value and, mm, capital. So we need that, and we need a very developed critical industry,
mm,
because the New York Times, the Guardians, literary, the Guardians of the world,
mm,
do not do right by our books at all.
No.
Right. They have zero concept on how to name,
yes,
what is interesting,
yes,
and valuable about,
yes,
our book.
Yes.
So we need spaces like that, machineries like, mm, that can kind of push our books globally,
mm,
on our own terms. Right, mm-hmm, on terms that make our literature visible, mm, and make the value of our literature visible.
Speaking of visibility, we've had some very popular people almost being given credits for popularizing African literature. So there've, mm-hmm, been collaborations, for example, with big stars that have been seen to be popularizing, mm-hmm, literature. So, I mean, there was an event where there was an occasion where Beyonce, you know, was referred to almost shining a light on Chimamanda Adichie, which I thought was interesting, you know, mm-hmm, and that same sort of sentiment was then carried on, mm-hmm, when Warson Shire appeared on Lemonade, you know, and it wasn't seen as this collaborative effort where people were bringing the equal weight of their work, yeah, right? And in an age where African literature is beginning to gain a lot of traction, a lot of interest with these kinds of collaborations, there's still this almost strange way of interpreting those relationships, mm-hmm, as though they are shining a light on us as opposed to it being a collaborative effort or us shining a light on them and bringing newfound ideas, newfound, mm-hmm, ways of interpreting that. And I really want to get your opinion on why you believe that African literature was shining a light on Beyonce and not the other way around.
I think that it feels very obvious to me,
mm,
because Lemonade aesthetically draws a lot from Warson Shire's work.
Yeah,
you know, it's like it's not as if you can tell that Beyoncé is working within an aesthetics that Shire created. Right, it's not just the poetry,
mm,
the very tenure, mm, of the poetry, right? The ways that it dissects a certain type of, like, you know, broken intimacy, right? That shows itself at the level of the body, at the level of history. Like, this is all stuff that Shire has been working with and thinking through with her poetry, in the sense that she made that project, but
yes,
somehow it's like, you know, like her presence in the work is overshadowed by saying that, you know, Beyonce saved her from obscurity.
Yes.
Right? Because everything is not about visibility, right? It's also about the transformative power of her work, mm-hmm. right? In the sense that her work transforms Beyoncé's work, right? Even though she might not have had the visibility that she had before. But I think that another way that you see this kind of power differential between the West and places like Africa when it comes to cultural objects mm-hmm. is also in this kind of intentional attempts to erase,
yes.
right?
Yes.
African influences in cultural forms. The most absurd example to me is Marlon James's Black Leopard, Red Wolf. I mean, I don't know how much else James can tell the world that that project is African.
Mm.
That it is based on his extensive research on medieval African worlds.
Mm, mm.
That he had studied his Tutuola, Amos Tutuola, a lot.
Mm.
And that many of the creatures he created was a homage to Tutuola.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times review of that book
mm.
does not mention one African influence of that book.
Mm.
And I mean, this guy mentions everything from Hieronymus Bosch, Marquez, Avengers. Okay? I mean, like George Martin.
Yeah.
Literally, you would think that this book had nothing to do with African literature.
Mm.
That the rich aesthetic formal legacy that this book is built on all of a sudden is erased and disappears
completely
in the circulation of this text within the West, right? And that's, I mean, and that's why, though, we need to be able to create our own global engines for circulating ideas about our literature.
Speaking of this, developing our own global engine, you've spoken about this development of a critical industry, and I think that's something that we're still struggling with because we find it difficult to write critically about each other in ways that are still loving and that are still tender and that are not destructive. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've found Brittle Paper to be able to do very well. And so my question is, how do you believe that we go about this creation or this development of a critical industry that seeks to build and not to destroy?
Yeah. I mean, the goal is to create a critical industry that is affirmative, right, and productive, in the sense that critiquing a text or writing about a text is about...
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
Assembling information around that text.
Mm.
Or making the value of that text legible within the African literary archive. It has nothing to do with whether you like this novel or you don't like the novel. That's a me. As the job, my job as a critic is not to say whether I like a book or I don't, or whether a book is bad or it's not.
Mm.
I consider my work as a critic done if I'm able to create significant, important information around a book, right? And this is tied to me to the way I look at a canon, right? A canon is not just a list of books.
Mm.
A canon is a very special type of list. It's a list where each text in the list can communicate what is great about it in relation to another text on the list, right? So, for example, when I talk about Marlon James's Black Leopard, Red Wolf, right? It's not a matter of whether the book was hard to read, it was annoying, I didn't like it. It's about how can I show you this text in relation to other texts within the literary canon? How can I ask interesting questions about the text? How can I produce a set of interesting information around the text? And so a critical industry that is focused on building is one that is focused on expanding and enriching an archive, right? As opposed to simply, I don't know, just tearing a text down or saying whether, really, honestly, nobody cares. But what I think is important for posterity is this kind of knowledge that we are assembling around our literary text. That's what's going to be important, right, for the future.
So you talk about this assembling of knowledge around literary texts and the creation of a canon. It's a question that we often come up with, just about the kind of work that you curate and want to, for example, have on the podcast, because you want to believe that you're creating this canon. And so my question is for you, what are some of the deliberate ways that you go about in your own quest to create this kind of canon and to drive this kind of knowledge base that exists around the work of African writers?
One way, I think, is this really simple and basic act of curation, right? So to think of yourself, which is what you also do at Chickenative, is to highlight a set of texts through the year, right? That you think that people should pay attention to. For us at Brittle Paper, we also do things like things as simple as creating lists, right?
Yes.
So for example, instead of saying that Mariama Ba's So Long a Letter, you see, novel about is a novel that explores female oppression, right? How about you assemble the text? You kind of create a list of text about, five novels by African women that explore powerful female friendships, which is actually what So Long a Letter is about. Is this really amazing relationship she has with this woman that literally every woman in the world has a friend like that, who you guys have been through everything together, but somehow your choices in lives have been different. You know, that's so, how about begin to reorganize the archives in ways that makes it more legible to people, so that you can say, five novels about heartbreaks, right? Five novels that talk about things that interesting ways of putting text together that readers are going to find intriguing, that kind of defamiliarizes the text to them and show them that, that look, this story speaks to very real and intimate aspects of their lives, and that it's not just that these texts aren't just about, checking the list on hot button issues.
Because there's so much more than that, and in many ways African literature is a tool for us to examine the full spectrum of who we are outside of all of the tick boxes that we have, the famine, the starvation, the difficulties, the poor governance, the corruption, and right? I think we've got that. We've got it down to a T. We know how to rise about African corruption.
Problems.
We've got it down to a T. You also have something quite interesting at the Brittle Paper, and it's the African Literary Person of the Year. And what's interesting is a number of the winners have been Black women. All of them have been Black women. But Black women who are slaying, right? And so my question is, has that been intentional on your part to have this continuous list of Black women as African Literary Persons of the Year? And what's informed that? Because, I mean, it's quite interesting because we often, when we think of African literature, people will want to talk about your Wole Soyinkas, mm-hmm. your Chinuas, you know. Mm-hmm. The when people think of the gods of African literature, the gods happen to be men. They happen to be the fathers, mm-hmm. you know. So I found that to be very interesting, that trend of African literary people being black women.
Well, that's something that we never planned at all. We give people, we award that category based on what people are doing in the industry. Mm. It's kind of an industry-focused award that looks at how people are building infrastructures that have been key to building the industry. And it just so happens that right now, as we speak, African women are the ones really, I mean, holding down the fort in different aspects of the industry. So that's one thing. But another thing that is curious is also that even in the literary side of things, is also being dominated by African women.
Yes.
I mean, Salman Rushdie's review of Namwali Sirpal's Old Drift, which was published in March, came out and he said that African women are coming, that African women are dominating the literary field. Mm-hmm. In 2014 or so, Soyinka, we actually have the video on Brittle Paper, had a Guardian video where he says that the women are kicking the asses of the men. So this is something that has actually been talked about. But it's just that now it's becoming the case that all the novelists making waves globally are women.
Yes.
And that all the kind of the people committed to doing industry things are women. Lola, in fact, Thando is an exception.
Yes.
He's an amazing exception to see. Because it almost feels as if, you know, when you look, women are the ones doing the heavy lifting, right? Industry-wise. But you know, the reason why I embrace the trend is because historically African literature has been a boys' club.
Yes.
And I mean, we've had horror stories of what women like Buchi Mecheta have experienced in an industry that was exclusively, cultishly held down by men. Right? In fact, there is this and I can send it to you. This professor, what's her name? Neamaka, did this beautiful piece where she does a survey of reviews by African male critic of women's novel. The condescending, like characters will be critiqued because they are too gossipy and they are talkative. Right? Characters will be critiqued because they are too wild and sexually free.
Mm.
Right. So this is like the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And so it's refreshing to see in a kind of discursive field where, you know, it's not just that men have been dominating, but that women have not been treated, you know, exceptionally nicely. It's good to see that, you know, women for some reason are the ones thriving now, are the ones, you know, writing all the amazing books and are the ones kind of holding power within the industry. I don't exactly know why, you know.
Black girl magic.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I celebrate it.
It's beautiful.
You know, and I love it.
So you're talking about Buchi Emeta, whose birthday it was this past week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her daughter wrote something so beautiful on Twitter. And this is the power of social media that's just made the world so much smaller.
Yeah.
Just about how Buchi was left alone in the UK and the process of what it means to be a woman writing under those kinds of conditions was quite interesting. There's a number of black women whose work you've read and whose work has resonated with you and maybe directed you in a certain path. And I'm interested to know, who those women were, those black women writers who changed the way that you read books, the way that you interacted with novels. But also, you've probably had a chance to revisit some of their work and What are some of the revisions that you've had now with somebody who interacts with literature in a completely different way to how you were when you initially read it?
Yeah, I will say that I have, to be honest, been more inspired by my contemporaries.
Okay.
Right? And I've also been inspired by these pioneers because I realize how difficult it was, right? And the barriers that they had to break in order for them to create the space where we can actually do what we are doing today. And in a way, their work shows me just how difficult and problematic a space they occupied. Yeah. Like, Buchir Mechasa is known to have said that, you know, her feminism is feminism with a small f, you know? And that there's a sense in which, you know, women's writings were focused on the kind of small domestic lives of women characters. So the Achebes of the world would write their grand historic epics, and then women could write about barrenness and infertility and, you know, wife beating and things like that, right? You know, that's so, you know, that while I kind of see the ways that they were able to kind of forge a path, even if it was sort of modest, but the work that they did is absolutely essential to the work that, you know, that women writers today are now doing. Of course, you know, writers like Flora Mwapa, you know, Mariama Ba, Buchi Mechita, of course, they are very, very extremely important to the kind of posture that I bring to my work. But I would say that in terms of writers that really inspire me today, it'll have to be my contemporaries, writers like Enedi Okorafo, and the ways that she has refused to accept the terms of storytelling, so that she's been able to create this completely new way of imagining African cultural and literary archives. People like that inspire me to no end.
So who else are some of the contemporaries? I found it very interesting that you feel that your contemporaries have been, because in many ways some writers feel a sense of competition with their contemporaries, and it's reflected in the ways in which they then interact with their contemporaries. So you ask somebody, oh, what are you reading now? Oh, I don't read contemporary work, I read classics, you know. It's almost an attitude of condescension, the way that people approach their contemporaries. So I find it very interesting that you draw so much inspiration from your contemporaries. And outside of issues of style and theme, what else particularly is so inspiring about the ways in which your contemporaries are going about navigating the literary space, but also the kinds of work that they're producing that stands out so strongly for you?
I mean, I think it's what I will call a kind of epistemic disobedience or resistance that I find in lots of this work, where they give zero fucks, and they are just going to completely change the terms in which we tell stories, the terms in which we imagine worlds. Another person I love dearly is Panache Chigumatsu.
Yes.
I mean, These Bones Shall Rise is, I mean, it's a text that when you read, it completely upends everything you know about how to tell national histories, how to tell account for women's histories within national histories, right? It changes everything you know about what counts as appropriate historical knowledge or not. You know, that's what that kind of, the kind of audaciousness of these writings to me just blows me away, because I, as somebody who studies the history and evolution of forms, I know how gradual those types of things can be, but with these writers, they are just taking on this kind of old, tired structures and completely breaking them down. what's her name? Oh my God, she's going to kill me. Novoyo Chuma, you know, House of Stone, is another very audacious take on a history of violence that she manages almost to kind of tell in this just hilarious, funny, amazing character, you know. So I don't know, I am intrigued by their inventiveness, let me call it that, by their inventiveness, by their just aggressively seeking out new ways to tell our stories. I think that is, you know, that's remarkable.
Speaking of new ways to tell our stories, there's a practice that you've criticized, and it speaks to the ways in which people tell our stories. And you've spoken about this tethering of creative practice to dysfunction as something that almost inhibits us being able to tell our stories in new ways. What do you mean by that?
I mean, like, when we can only justify literary practice on dysfunctionality, that's just very limiting. You know, because dysfunction is never the whole story.
Yes.
Right? It's the problem I have with Ngugi's Decolonizing the Mind. Like, I'm sorry, Africans were not cultural schizophrenics.
Yes.
You know, Africans were not, like, culturally meant, psychically, cognitively broken people. Just because, you know, colonialism was a horrible thing, and it did lots of things. But to then create this continent full of people,
yes,
you know, that to me is not the whole story, because every day there were Africans who were doing interesting things, who were, you know, creating things, who were kind of, you know, actively finding new ways to live their lives and represent their world. And so when we use dysfunction as a starting point, it prevents us from acknowledging the creativities, you know, that was taking place even within the context of that dysfunction. And so we have to find another starting point that allows us to acknowledge the dysfunctions that are there, but that also allows us to name the joys and the creativity and inventions that were also there.
Speaking of the joys and the creativities, it's almost the end. Well, we were two-thirds in of 2019, and it's been quite an exciting literary year. You know, so what have been some of the books that you've really enjoyed in 2019, and what are some of the books that you're looking forward to as the year progresses?
I mean, I was particularly moved by Nnedi Okorafor's Broken Places, Outer Spaces. I could never tell the right order, her memoir. You know, because I think for somebody who has always kind of presented this really powerful persona, and she is a very powerful person, woman, you know, to kind of now go back and tell this story of just immense vulnerability, you know, I found it surprising and inspiring. I am looking forward to reading Maza Mengistu's The Shadow King, because there's been a ton of historical fiction, again, 99% by African women.
Yes.
Petina Gapa's Out of the Light, A Shining Darkness, also another historical fiction. I think one of the stories that has sort of blindsided me, to be honest, is Namwali Sepe's Old Drift, right? Just epic and grand and ambitious and genre bending, you know. And that's a text that I haven't read yet, but that I am looking forward to reading.
So Brittle Paper has these awards that you give out. What is the aim of these awards? You've just spoken about, we had an interesting conversation about what literary awards do and what we hope. What do you hope that the Brittle Paper Awards will do?
I think I want to, or rather we would like to make people realize the immense treasure we have in digital publishing. And this is a blind spot that you find globally. It's not just an African thing, is that when we institutional things like prizes are still wired to books, right, which is odd to me, and especially in a place like Africa where we have, where the publishing, the print publishing industry is dismal. Most of the new interest in writing happening is actually being published digital first, right? But so why aren't we celebrating writing that has never had a life in print and that has simply been published online, right? So that for us is the goal, that we can find a way where we can reward these writers who are kind of, you know, finding new interesting ways to leverage the digital space for literary work. And also social media, you know, like in at Brittle Paper, we don't find social media to be a scandalous thing.
We don't. Louder for the people at the back, because wow, there's a sense of almost like literary superiority.
Yes.
Like, yes. You know, we're still publishing books. Yeah. You know, people should read and stop tweeting. It's quite interesting in terms of...
Darling, I mean, tweets have changed the world in ways that I don't think many books would ever dream to. And it's not as if I'm saying that we should replace digital-first writing with print, but it's just that it's already a competing media context.
Yes.
It's the reason why we are not focusing on it is because we are in some kind of weird denial. Shailja Patel's post-colonial tweets in response to Chimamanda Adichie's statement about post-colonial theory being something that, you know, professors invented to get jobs, right? And she wrote this set of, I think, 14 tweets that kind of gives a Marxist feminist account of post-colonial theory. Was republished on Brittle Paper, and within 4 days had 60,000 views.
I remember those tweets, like,
right? I mean, that in the way that in 14 tweets she names, tells you what exactly is essential about post-colonial theory as a framework, right? And that's so, but to me, I feel like, but there's no space to reward her for what those tweets did, because it's not an essay on the Atlantic, on the New Yorker, right? So
it hasn't been retweeted, or it hasn't been on Oprah's book club list, you know?
You know?
Yeah.
So what we did, I mean, she sent in those tweets as part of her nominating herself, and she ended up winning that category. And to me, you know, that is
powerful.
Awesome. I love that. And I think that we need kind of more experimental institutional spaces that allows us to figure out what kinds of value we are going to ascribe to this tremendously powerful work that is being created in spaces outside of print.
In lots of spaces outside of print, Brittle Paper's published quite a few anthologies since 2016. There was We Are Flowers, quite a few of them that were, and they have very different themes as well. So how do you go about the process of selecting the work that gets published, but also choosing the themes? They're very different, but they're also very context and very in keeping with what's happening at the time.
Yes.
We Are Flowers is one such example.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we work with editors, and our deputy editor, Otto Siriezi, is the one who typically leads these collaborations. And he works with the editor to make sure that this the selected works are very good, not only in terms of quality, but that, you know, they are great and provocative, and that they can move people to ask the kinds of questions that they need to. So some of the anthologies we've kind of pushed originally by ourselves, but what has happened in the last few years is that people are coming, are approaching us and saying, look, I have an idea for an anthology. Will you guys kind of work with us and collaborate with us and give us a space where we can kind of, you know, publish it? And we've been doing more of that, and it's really exciting because it allows us to circulate text that typically will not necessarily find its way, you know, within kind of the traditional publishing circuits. I mean, it's a reason why brittle paper has come to be seen as a kind of bastion for queer writing, right? Because we started publishing queer writing long before anybody started. The Nigerian poet, Ori Ogun, who is now at Harvard, published with us first, right? And that has kind of been one aspect of our work that we love, that we cherish, and that we find endlessly rewarding. That brittle paper is an open and safe space for queer writers to explore any kind of question regarding queer culture.
So we've spoken a lot about brittle paper, which is amazing, and what's next we will discuss. But what's next for you? You finished your PhD. You're in the process of turning that work into a novel.
Into a book.
Sorry. And I'm really curious about what it's like to be on the other side. So, as somebody who consumes a lot of literature, you teach literature, you study it critically, you're now in the process of turning this work into a book. And really, what is it like to now straddle the other side of that?
I think it's exciting, you know? It's exciting. Just crafting the book has been an exciting journey. And I see crafting because that's what it is.
Yes.
You know, I've been in the industry long enough to know the kind of book I want to write.
Yes.
You know, I am an academic, but I'm also a literary blogger. So there's a way that, you know, my sensibilities and the way I ask questions is very much inspired by these two different worlds.
Mm.
So that I know the specific kind of book I want to write, and a book that is making interventions in a very specific way. I mean, I could write a kind of good old, you know, typical scholarly text on African literature that simply just, you know, finds a paradigm. You know, it may be, I don't know, post-colonial or feminist, and just kind of slap it on a particular, not very research period in African literature. Mm. That's not what I want to do.
Mm.
For me, the unique perspective I have and position I have within the kind of popular literary sphere has kind of made me realize even much more the ways that things need to change on an epistemic level, in the sense that, you know, the way we talk about storytelling and the way we talk about texts, you know, from the level of what it means to be a character, right? See, that how we define a character or how we define what a setting does is still very much Eurocentric. And it's not to say those paradigms are not are bad. It's just that they're not cut like one size fit all, right? The two, we have to begin to kind of reshape these categories in ways that makes our texts and our archives more legible. So so that's why I'm kind of taking my time to put together this book that I hope will speak to these different concerns and this kind of seemingly different worlds of like popular literary discourse and academic literary discourse that I inhabit.
And can you give us a sneak peek of what your book is about, just to tantalize our listeners? Just a sneak peek. One or two lines.
My book is a kind of experimental genealogy of the African novel.
Okay.
It's based on the assumption that we should pretend for a second that the novel was not invented in Europe.
Mm. Okay.
And so instead of tracing the genealogy of the African novel as this thing that was invented by Europe and then came to Africa and then just kind of picked up local color, right? What if we trace the African novel from within the African literary archive itself? So what if we started from, you know, 16th century Ethiopian hagiographic texts?
Yes.
What if we started from Ifa divinatory corpus? What if we started from kind of old epics like the Ozidi saga, Sunjata, or 17th century Swahili poetry? What if we started from there. And then excavated this literary archive and isolated forms that we can then bring into the contemporary moment and begin to use to explain why African novels are different?
Yes.
Why they are weird in this cool way in which they are weird. Why they are interesting and they are doing all these things that are just, that seems strange.
Yeah.
Because we keep trying to explain it in relationship to the European invention of the form. All of a sudden, we begin to see how these novels are much more exciting and much more interesting and much more dynamic than we've imagined them to be. The title of my book is Forest Imaginaries, How African Novels Think.
We can't wait. Thank you so much for what's really been such a brilliant, insightful interview. It's so funny because the other day somebody said that we often sound like we're fangirling when we speak to writers on the podcast. And I think so much of what you've spoken about speaks to that inability to critically engage in ways that are not destructive with people whose work we enjoy. So, I mean, I just want to close off with you just telling us about what kind of future you hope for writers, for the Brittle paper, but also for African writing in general. What is it that you are hoping for in doing this project? What does the future look like?
I mean, I'm looking forward to a future in which we control the terms on which our literature is defined.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And all the systemic and infrastructural evolution or changes or transformations that have to kind of create that and make it possible. I would like a world in which, you know, you don't need to be reviewed on the New York Times for your book to be able to actually circulate globally, right? They're actually African spaces, you know, that are that powerful, you know? I would like a world in which we have more literary festivals on the continent, you know, where we don't have to, you know, go to Europe and, you know, play
to
this exotic sizing game, you know, and just exist in spaces where you feel out of joints and out of sorts, in spaces where you struggle to find the language to articulate what your work is or what it does. It would be nice to have more Ake festivals, more Bantu festivals. It'll be nice to have, you know, a space where we are able to leverage digital technology. So we want more cheeky natives, you know? We want more bookstagrammers, you know, working in Africa. We want more brittle papers, right? Just a really rich and vibrant space. And also, to be honest, when you think about literature within social media, right? And I mean literature, not just literary discourse, but the ways that social media is opening up new ways of telling stories. So Twitter stories, you know, Twitter stories, Facebook memoirs, things like that, right? We live at the cusp of a kind of grand literary shift where everything right now is up for grabs, right?
Yes.
Europeans invented the novel. We don't know who is going to invent the next digital narrative, right?
that so this is a playing field where I'm seeing African writers kind of really explore all kinds of experimental narratives using social media. I already see it. So my goal is that I'm wishing for a future in which whatever the kind of literary equivalent of the novel is within the digital space, that it's one that the continent, you know, will have kind of been the incubating space for.
And with that very powerful note, I'm going to end our podcast, but I really want to say a very, very big thank you to Dr. Adora Glines. It's important for us to use people's titles for really the amazing work that Brittle Paper does, where I think we don't often take time to just take stock of the kind of work that we're doing, and we always hope for these very big, big moments that we'll celebrate. But so much of the work and so much of the change is in the little everyday things, that the spaces that we create, the platforms that we give to people. So I'm quite excited for your new work. We wish you all the best. Brittle Paper grows from strength to strength. We can only imagine what lies ahead in the future as we reimagine ourselves and reimagine the way we speak about ourselves, the ways we write about ourselves, the way we portray ourselves in our books as well, in our writing. So thank you once again.
Thanks to you for taking the time out to chat with me. Thank you very much.